is CBS, Eye on the World, the New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. I am John Batchelor, and I go to a recent essay in Foreign Affairs, a distinguished publication by professors such as Evan Ellis and his colleagues about world affairs that take not only the present breaking news, but also look into the path ahead and the path behind. And Venezuela is a rich topic. So a recent essay by Michael Shifter, adjunct professor at the Edmund A. Wall School of Foreign Service at Georgetown from 2010 to 2022, reestablishes my understanding of what a quandary Venezuela has become because the man Nicolas Maduro was underestimated, I'm told, when he was a lieutenant of the late Mr. Chavez, the very charismatic and outspoken and energetic leader who had transformed Venezuela from one of the great economies, prosperous of the new world, of the world, because of its oil revenue and its educated population, transformed it into one man, one vote, one time, changed the constitution, and was very much in the Caudillo style of charismatic leadership until his untimely death from cancer. Maduro, who was seen, I remember him first introduced to me and my audience as the bus driver, was seen as not up to the scale of Chavez's leadership. Professor Michael Shifter, the professor writing at Foreign Affairs, he's surprised by Maduro, not only his survivability, but his sophisticated way of being. He calls him pragmatic. Are you surprised as well? Thank you.
Thank you, John. Well, Michael's long been one of the kind of leading voices in the center on Latin America, and certainly his piece in Foreign Affairs gives a nice tour de force of the mess that is Venezuela and how we got there with Chavez and Maduro as well, and with some suggestions about where we might want to take things in the future. I personally, along with Michael and others, really kind of followed the sad story deepening. And I would say that it's not so much an issue of surprise as an issue of a tragedy that has fallen this long. The part of the historical context was that you had, with just so much cynicism with the vast Venezuelan oil wealth, years and years where you had alternation in power between the traditional parties, the CD and the COPE. And so when Hugo Chavez, first as a military officer back in 1992, tried to institute a coup against the democratic order, and then later was pardoned and ran as president and was actually elected president. In many ways, it was the disillusionment of Venezuelans with democracy and the fact that the marginalized that Hugo Chavez and the Venezuelan military seemed to represent were a fresh voice. Chavez, however, who worked closely with the Cubans gradually restructured the Venezuelan army, restructured the economy little by little, basically shaped his battles and moved against the elites. Venezuela was so strongly a U.S. ally. It was, even more strongly, arguably, than Colombia came to be later. And so for many Venezuelan elites, it was hard to imagine a world in which they would not be that close to the United States, and in which the military wouldn't be close to the United States, and in which Venezuela would not be a wealthy country. Really seeing this series of losses of battles, and by the time I think that many elites in Venezuela realized how grave things had become by the mid-2000s, it was very, very, very difficult. Now, what I think Michael does a good job on also is suggesting just, the expectation of Democrats and others in Venezuela, even under Maduro, that, this would as a very difficult situation in terms of if you lack a strong economic basis. We assume in the United States and elsewhere that you have issue voters who say, the leadership is doing a bad job with the economy. The leadership is doing a bad job with the foreign policy. We're going to vote them out of office. However, between the espionage of the Cubans who were integrated into the Venezuelan government and the armed forces, restructuring of the armed forces, the involvement of those, various elites, who basically became complicit in criminal activities, you essentially created a situation in which, although a lot of people didn't like the management style of of Maduro. Everyone had become so complicit and was so afraid of what could replace them and the consequences if a real democracy ever returned, that despite the tremendous pressure that was put on Venezuela with sanctions and other activities during especially President Trump's administration, that the Venezuelans, although there were some cracks, the edifice really did not crumble. And so in many ways, the most recent kind of sad chapter where you have the kind of the acknowledgement of the failure of the attempt of the de jure president, Juan Guaido, to be able to reinstitute democracy, his basically being voted out of that role after having essentially failed, the disillusionment and divisions within the Venezuelan opposition that led some to collaborate with Maduro for lack of anything more promising, others to try to hold on. And so the situation in which now to try to get access to a little bit of Venezuelan oil because of the current situation with Russia, that the Biden administration has now taken things in a different direction, saying, OK, we'll work with you on oil. We'll try to give you some concessions to get you back to the negotiating table. But if you step back from the details and look back, Guaido is gone. Maduro is still in power. You have a largely, unknown, although, well-meaning, new representative of the Venezuelan opposition, Dierno Figuera. But this kind of long tortured journey suggests that if you have criminally complicit people and the people with the guns essentially don't break, and you have the help of intelligence services immersed throughout your governing and security apparatus, it's really, really hard to bring about political change absent military action from external sources. And I think that's part of the sad lesson of Venezuela, which whose economic failure and whose other deterioration has seen some 7 million plus Venezuelans immigrate not only to Colombia, but all parts of the region, reflecting just the horrible conditions both in security and economically in their country.
The choice for Venezuela, and I'm thinking, in a science fiction fashion, do we become a beachhead for the enemies of the United States, or do we turn into a pirate haven, plundering the environment, plundering our neighbors, using drugs and drug smuggling as an easy source of revenue, and undermining the values of civilization around us? Those are the two choices that I'm imagining. Is Venezuela a beachhead for Russia and China and Tehran, or is it a pirate haven, not unlike what existed, say, in New Orleans in the early part of the American Republic, to be cleaned out by gunboat diplomacy? Which is it, Professor?
John, I wish that was the choice, but unfortunately, Venezuela has become both a beachhead for enemies of the United States and a refuge and haven for pirates. And it's ironic because historically, Venezuela was considered one of the backwaters of the Spanish colonial empire. As a matter of fact, back then, Venezuela was where the pirates literally would take refuge with respect to the Caribbean and elsewhere. Because again, it wasn't one of the strong points of Spanish colonial governance. But today you do have those two things. And so to me, at its core, it is the consolidation of power by a criminally tied regime. And under that, you've had Venezuela not only become increasingly a transit state for narcotics, but actually now a source zone, according to the authoritative groups like Inside Crime, for coca production, for cocaine labs complementing Colombia, vast criminality with respect to illegal mining, which is destroying the Venezuelan economy and has made given Venezuela a source for illicit gold, the operation of a number of different both politically and non-political criminal groups, especially the ELN supporting their operations in Colombia, as well as a range of others. And so sadly, Venezuela, on the one hand, it's almost become a franchise of criminality, which again has been one of the key things that's kept the Venezuelan regime alive. And even though people are not excited about what's going on in Caracas, better to have a lack of an effective governance in Caracas, as long as that permits those with the criminal franchises to continue to work, than having something more manageable. But in the context, Venezuela also, initially for China with its Venezuela's 300 billion barrels of recoverable oil, also for key Russian players, such as the oil magnate Igor Sechin, to a lesser degree in terms of mining, with the Corporación Venezuela de Guyana and the interest of entities like Rosoro and Rusal, there in mining. And so, really that collaboration also then has become a base for political collaboration. You saw it initially with the Chinese in largely economic terms. Then you saw it in a more, threatening fashion with respect to Russian military support, the purchasing of over $12 billion of Russian arms. And then when the cash ran out, continuing Russian support for Venezuela's, air defenses and training of forces, et cetera, even the conduct of military exercises at a small scale on Venezuelan soil. And then, of course, other threat actors such as Iran. With what's called the Quds forces in Iran, as well as others. And of course, you saw the oil collaboration between the Iranian oil organization accepting payment in basically illicit Venezuelan gold and helping Venezuela then get its refinery infrastructure up, but helping it to buy dilutants so that it could produce at least some oil. And so just really across the space, you have a convergence of essentially a criminally complicit authoritarian government that has really made itself a platform of access to all of the bad actors in the region, and has really used those bad actors to maintain itself in a security sense and an economic sense in power. And of course, we haven't even gotten to talk about the Cubans that I mentioned before, who supplied, some of the key, intelligence personnel and others whose penetration of the Venezuelan security forces, and government entities have helped essentially make it resistant to some of the coups, or coup attempts of those who have wanted to return Venezuela to democracy and break the power of the Chavez and the Maduro regimes.
I'm looking for a rosy scenario in Professor Schifter's essay, and I have this. There's a suggestion that Gustavo Petro in Bogota, recently elected, and Lula da Silva in Brasilia, recently elected, are not unsympathetic to Maduro's claims of being a new kind of leader in Latin America, center-left, but at the same time are not sympathetic to the piracy, to the brutality, and even to the invitation to Tehran and its bad actors. So I think there's a suggestion that Petro and Lula da Silva will correct or at least subdue Maduro's bad instincts. Is that too rosy?
Well, John, I think some of us would call that wishful thinking. Petro does not like to be associated with some of the more, onerous abuses of Maduro, nor does Lula. But it's one thing to, mildly grumble about, how this is not the best among friends. And it's another thing to actually, have leaders who are willing to take steps and incur, political capital to change things. And I don't think we've seen those indications. And really the core issue is that when you have a regime such as Venezuela, where absent of external military intervention, which is just not going to happen, that there are really no signs of a return to democracy. What are your choices? The two basic choices are that you take all steps that you can in recognizing the nature of that regime, to isolate it and prevent that regime from growing more powerful and more wealthy and sowing trouble elsewhere, which is a key problem that we've seen with those from Venezuela and Cuba throughout the other region in their internal politics. Or you say, well, we can't change things, and so we are going to give them an opening to the rest of the world and say, if we can't change them, we make nice. This is the U.S. dilemma with Cuba as well, is the inability to change policy on Cuba a reason for saying, okay, well, we give up, we're going to engage them because we can't change the regime. And so that's the fundamental dilemma, and I would submit it's really kind of the fundamental difference of opinion of many towards Venezuela. Those who believe in the importance, although you can't change the regime, or at least it's not likely, that the importance of continuing to stand for principle, albeit at some cost to the Venezuelan people, and basically preventing that criminal authoritarian regime from doing even more damage in the region. Or do you kind of give up and try naively to engage it, and in the process basically open the door and legitimize the regime, which is what others in the region are trying to do. And it seems like we're kind of shifting in the direction of the engagement and legitimization in the interest of a little bit oil. And I would say very very superficial hopes that somehow Maduro will you know, at least wink and nod towards democracy, which he every once in a while says that he's going to do. But I think the record suggests that as in Cuba, this has been a bit of a failed policy to think that you can bring about democracy in the country.
Professor Avenelis, U.S. Army War College, we're headed to the west side of South America, the Andean chain, three troubled nations. This is The New World Report. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.